This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Warum nur an der Oberfläche kratzen? Bei einem Atemwegsinfekt ganz dünnes Eis.
Wenn Erkältungsviren auf die Bronchien schlagen, packt Umkaluabo den Infekt mit der Wurzel. Denn es lindert nicht nur die Symptome, sondern bekämpft auch die Erreger.
Umkaluabo.
Unaussprechlich, aber ausgesprochen gut.
Zu Risiken und Nebenwirkungen lesen Sie die Packungsbeilage und fragen Sie Ihre Ärztin, Ihren Arzt oder in Ihrer Apotheke.
Japanese women are known for having tiny waistlines and one in five young women there are underweight. But Japan's most followed comedian, Naomi Watanabe, is shaking things up. I'm Hannah Gelbart and I've been chatting to her about how she is breaking Japanese body image norms and adapting to life in the Big Apple. You can listen to our conversation on What in the World, a daily podcast that explains what's happening in the world every weekday in less than 15 minutes. You can find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from our studios in central London. I'm Julian Marshall. President Zelensky met Donald Trump today for the first time since the US president began unilateral negotiations with Russia earlier this month, and it didn't go well. Ukraine and Europe have so far been excluded from these negotiations, but Mr. Zelensky and Mr. Trump had been expected to sign an agreement giving the United States access to Ukraine's mineral and energy resources. Instead, the encounter descended into a bad-tempered shouting match between the two men in front of the world's media, with the Vice President, J.D. Vance, noisily chipping in. We're playing an extended extract of this unprecedented public exchange, which marks a new low in the already strained relations between Washington and Kiev. It began with a question from Mr. Vance to President Zelensky.
For 4 years in the United States of America, we had a president who stood up at press conferences and talked tough about Vladimir Putin, and then Putin invaded Ukraine and destroyed a significant chunk of the country. The path to peace and the path to prosperity is maybe engaging in diplomacy. We tried the pathway of Joe Biden of thumping our chest and pretending that the President of the United States' words mattered more than the President of the United States' actions. What makes America a good country is America engaging in diplomacy. That's what President Trump is doing.
Can I ask you?
Sure.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. So he occupied our parts, big parts of Ukraine, part of East and Crimea. He occupied it on 2014. During a lot of years, so I'm not speaking about just Biden, but those time was President Obama, then President Trump, then President Biden, now the President Trump, and God bless, now President Trump will stop him. But during 2014, nobody stopped him. He just occupied and took. He killed people. You know what the contact
2015.
Line?
2014. 2014 and 2014.
Yeah, yeah. So
I was not here.
Yeah, but
that's exactly right.
Yes, but during 2014 till 2022, the situation the same. The people have been dying on the contact line. Nobody stopped him. You know that we had conversations with him, a lot of conversations, my bilateral conversation, and we signed with him, me, like a new president. In 2019, I signed with him the deal. I signed with him, Macron and Merkel, we signed ceasefire. Ceasefire. All of them told me that he will never go. We signed him with gas contract. Yes, but after that, he broken the ceasefire. He killed our people and he didn't exchange prisoners. We signed the exchange of prisoners, but he didn't do it. What kind of diplomacy, JD, you are speaking about? What do you mean?
I'm talking about the kind of diplomacy that's going to end the destruction of your country.
Yes, but if you
Mr. President, with respect, I think it's disrespectful for you to come into the Oval Office and try to litigate this in front of the American media. Right now, you guys are going around and forcing conscripts to the front lines because you have manpower problems. You should be thanking the president for trying to bring an end to this conflict.
Have you ever been to Ukraine that you say what problems we have?
I have been to.
Come once.
I've actually watched and seen the stories, and I know what happens is you bring them on a propaganda tour, Mr. President. Do you disagree that you've had problems? bringing people into your military?
We have problems.
And do you think that it's respectful to come to the Oval Office of the United States of America and attack the administration that is trying to prevent the destruction of your country?
A lot of questions. Let's start from the beginning.
Sure.
First of all, during the war, everybody has problems. Even you, but you have nice ocean and don't feel now, but you will feel it in the future.
You will not have a war. Don't tell us what we're going to feel. We're trying to solve a problem. Don't tell us what we're going to feel.
I'm not telling you.
Because
I'm
you're in no position to dictate that.
That's
remember
exactly
this.
I'm not
dictating. You're in no position to dictate what we're going to feel. We're going to feel very good.
You will feel influenced.
We're going to feel very good and very strong.
You will feel influenced.
You're right now not in a very good position. You've allowed yourself to be in a very bad position, and he happens to be right about it.
From the very beginning of the war,
you're not in a good position. You don't have the cards right now. With us, you start having
cards.
Right now, you don't. You're playing cards. You're playing cards. You're gambling with the lives of millions of people. You're gambling with World War III. You're gambling with World War III. And what you're doing is very disrespectful to the country, this country. That's backed you far more than a lot of people said they should have.
Have you said thank you once? This entire meeting? No, in this entire meeting, have you said thank you? You went to Pennsylvania and campaigned for the opposition in October. Offer some words of appreciation for the United States of America and the president who's trying to save your country.
Please, you think that if you will speak very loudly about the war,
he's not speaking loudly. He's not speaking loudly. Your country is in big trouble.
Can I answer?
Wait a minute. No, no. You've done a lot of talking. Your country is in big trouble.
I know.
You're not winning.
I know.
You're not winning this. You have a damn good chance of coming out okay because of us.
Mr. President, we are staying in our country, staying strong from the very beginning of the war. We've been alone, and we are thankful. I said thanks
in
this cabinet.
You haven't been alone.
In this cabinet.
We gave you, through this stupid president, $350 billion.
You voted for your
president. We gave you military equipment, and
your
men are brave, but they had to use our military.
What about West?
If you didn't have our military equipment,
you invited me.
If you didn't have our military equipment, this war would have been over in 2 weeks.
In three days. I heard it from Putin. In 3 days. This is something
maybe
new.
Less.
In 2 weeks. Of course, yes.
It's going to be a very hard thing to do business like this, I tell you.
Well, some strong words there in that testy exchange involving President Trump, his vice president, and President Zelensky in the Oval Office of the White House. Only a few hours ago, and shortly after that exchange, Mr. Zelensky left the White House before a scheduled news conference, while the White House confirmed that the proposed mineral agreement had not, surprisingly, been signed. Well, to get some reaction, we can speak live now to Professor Scott Lucas of the Clinton Institute at University College Dublin. And in a word, I suppose anybody looking on would have been lost for words.
I wasn't lost for words, but I won't repeat them on air.
Okay.
Give me
a broadcastable reaction then.
Yeah, let me check the emotions and try to do this analytically. I mean, the first thing is I felt like I was watching in real time the demise of the U.S. as an influential power in global affairs, sacrificing the Ukrainian people in the process. That any type of authority, you know, political, diplomatic, certainly moral, was just being tossed aside by J.D. Vance and Donald Trump. I think as an analyst, I got to rewind, and that I'm glad you played that full clip in terms of exactly what it happened, in terms of why it may have happened. It's interesting to me that Zelensky, who of course is there trying to get a U.S. security guarantee, J.D. Vance jumps into the conversation, and he does so to trash Joe Biden. And to praise Donald Trump. Now, that's standard fare. Trump likes to be praised. But he talks about how Trump is bringing diplomacy back. Zelensky gives a very detailed explanation, which in effect is, look, we tried diplomacy since Vladimir Putin seized part of our country in 2014. We tried to negotiate with him, and he kept killing our people. And you'll notice when Trump jumps in, he doesn't even know the date of when Crimea was seized by Ukraine. But Zelensky's trying to explain this patiently. And then he asks Vance the question. He says, JD, tell me what this diplomacy is. And Vance just absolutely blows up at that point. you know, you're disrespecting us, you're playing to the media, you should be grateful, you should bow down and thank us, you know, and Trump follows up trying to exact tribute. So I'm playing this back in my mind and I'm thinking from Trump's point of view, his ego has been insulted. So I can read Trump. What I actually fear, and I mean, it's even greater than the U.S. not providing the security guarantee for Ukraine, is that this was a planned ambush.
Okay.
That J.D. Vance wanted to lure Zelensky into this because he all along has wanted not to provide any aid to Ukraine and to try to humiliate Zelensky at the same time.
President Zelensky seemed baffled at times as to what was actually happening.
From reading his body language, he was frustrated. He was frustrated that Trump was trying to treat him and Putin as equivalents, right? So Trump starts off before the whole blow up that you play by talking about, look, I'm dealing with both. I like both President Putin and you. Putin will accept a deal. We can work with him, right? And from Zelensky's point of view, he's not there to hear about why there should be direct talks between the U.S. and Russia, which have excluded Ukraine and Europe. He's not here to say that. He's there to get a commitment of U.S. support for Ukraine against the aggressor. And given the context, which Zelensky knows quite well, that the U.S. has even refused to call out the Russian aggression at the U.N., at the G7, and at the G20 this week, he's sitting thinking, what do I have to do to try to persuade these folks? And I got to be honest with you, he also realizes, as most of us do, that Donald Trump really doesn't know that much about what's happening inside his country. And so, yeah, he let that be shown a little bit in his body language.
I mean, arguably, we have been aware of these differences between Kiev and Washington, and it has now burst poisonously out into the open. Mm. Could it just be that this is a lancing of the boil?
It's actually something which I think is far more serious in terms of consequences, which is that the events of this week, which were Emmanuel Macron, French president, in Washington Monday, Keir Starmer, UK prime minister yesterday, Zelensky today, was all part of a coordinated Ukraine-European effort, which is to give it one last go at getting a U.S. security guarantee, specifically the use of U.S. air power in Poland and Romania, to protect any troops, including British and French troops, sent into Western Ukraine to protect facilities. And that's why the minerals deal was signed. It was going to be the opening stage because it gives Trump something he wanted to try to get that guarantee. And it all just went up in smoke. There will now be no U.S. security guarantee of any kind for Ukraine or European security. And that's why you've seen, by my count, we're getting close to 20 European leaders who have expressed support for Zelensky quite fervently. They realize now that any hope that the U.S. is involved in trying to defend Ukraine against Russia's invasion is probably gone. So now Europe and other countries are going to have to step up to the mark.
So this really is a very decisive moment, Professor, very briefly.
I think it's one of the most important moments since 1945. I've been saying in recent days that I think for the first time since 1941, we have a U.S. government which is not allied with Europe. The immediate importance, of course, is for the people of Ukraine, you know, many, many millions of whom have suffered because of the Russian invasion. But there are now broader questions about whether the U.S. even wants to be part of working with the U.K., working with other countries in Europe to provide for basic security. Okay. And on the evidence of what we saw today, I think Donald Trump is in the inner circle. There are some adults in the room who want to work with us, but not those people.
Professor Scott Lucas of the Clinton Institute at University College Dublin. And we stay with that bad-tempered shouting match between the leaders of two countries which are formerly allies in repelling President Putin's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Vitaly Shevchenko is Russia editor at BBC Monitoring. And Vitaly, firstly, Russia's reaction. They're making much of what I think they're calling this dressing down of President Zelensky by President Trump.
Well, absolutely, Julian. They are showing parts of the exchange repeatedly. And frankly, they don't even have to add much comment to what Russian TV viewers are being shown. After all, this is what Vladimir Putin worked towards for so many years, a falling out between Ukraine and the United States, a falling out between America and its closest allies in Europe. I've also been looking at reactions within Ukraine, and one theme that comes out very strongly, Julian, is that this spat brings back memories of February 2022 when the full-scale invasion started. A lot of people, such as, for example, the Interior Minister, Ihor Klimenko, are saying, we didn't give up then, we won't now. So there's a feeling that now Ukraine's sovereignty is being attacked by two countries, Russia and America. And Volodymyr Zelensky himself has been, or his account on X, formerly Twitter, has been thanking all these European leaders expressing support for Ukraine one by one. But what that shows us is that European leaders and Ukraine and America are sort of opposing each other ideologically and on key issues of security. The rift is really clear. What happens next is less than clear, because Volodymyr Zelensky has two choices, really, eating humble pie and biting his lip and trying to sort of get Donald Trump back on board. But that would be sort of humiliating politically at home.
You asked, you know, where do we go from here? And we have just had this from a US State Department spokesperson. Zelensky has the chance to turn this around. Will he be feeling inclined to do so after that, what might be described as very public humiliation in that Oval Office?
Well, whatever his feelings are or were in the Oval Office, he's now facing the very real option of American aid stopping. So he would be hoping that this summit of European leaders on Sunday will come up with some solution that will make up for whatever American assistance disappears. But there are severe doubts about whether Europe can afford it. So it's hard to see how Volodymyr Zelensky, or part of him, or part of his entourage, would not be pushed towards trying to seek some sort of reconciliation with Donald Trump. Because the truth is, Ukraine, without American assistance, will have a much, much harder task of containing Russian aggression, which still continues. I'm just looking at reports from the mayor of Kharkiv in eastern Ukraine, who says that central parts of the city are being attacked by Russian drones. So the pressure on Ukraine and its president is immense at the moment.
Vitaly, many thanks. That was Vitaly Shevchenko, Russia editor at BBC Monitoring. The Oscars take place on Sunday, and one of the hopefuls is Japanese journalist and filmmaker Shiori Ito, whose debut Black Box Diaries is in the running for Best Documentary Feature. Shiori Ito, who's become a symbol of Japan's Me Too movement, is the first Japanese director to be nominated in this category. The film follows the rape case she filed in 2015 against former high-profile journalist Noriyuki Yamaguchi and the public response to it for defying societal norms and speaking out as a victim. Despite being shown in more than 50 countries worldwide, the documentary has still not been screened in Japan. Our Tokyo correspondent Shaima Khalil caught up with Ms. Ito as she was in Paris promoting her film.
I have a chance to talk about what happened to me. I'm scared, but all I want to do is talk about the truth.
When Shiori Ito decided to speak about her rape allegations in 2017, she knew she was standing in the face of a society that preferred victims to be silent. At the time, Japan's rape laws hadn't changed for more than a century. The onus was on the victim to prove that either violence or intimidation was involved in the sex act. or that they were incapable of resistance. In the opening scene of her documentary Black Box Diaries, Shiori is speaking to the camera a few days before she holds a press conference, something, she tells me, her family was against.
For instance, my father. He's not, you know, especially strict. He's quite liberal. But then the first reaction when I told him I'm planning to go public, he said, your life is going to be in danger and over. In many ways, my career, but especially as a woman.
Black Box Diaries, which is Shiori's directorial debut, is based on her memoir. It follows the young reporter's quest for justice in a rape criminal case she filed in 2015 against well-known journalist Noriyuki Yamaguchi, who also had a close relationship with the late former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe as his biographer. Shiori decides to go public after the police and the prosecutors dismiss her allegations for lack of evidence. In 2019, she won a civil case against Yamaguchi, who's always denied the allegations. In doing so, Shiori became the symbol of the Me Too movement in Japan.
I want to break the idea of perfect victim, because that was what stopping me. People telling me, you're not crying enough talking to the policeman. You're not wearing proper clothes when I'm doing press conference. There are moments I'm not proud of, but I want to put all of it in.
The film has been screened in dozens of countries and is now in the running for Best Documentary Feature Film at this year's Academy Awards. Shiori is the first Japanese director to be nominated in this category.
It took some moment to understand we really got in. It was almost 11 p.m. in Japan time. Everyone was at my home in Tokyo, my best friend who's been always supporting me, all the film crews. We just cried with joy.
America Academy 賞に nominated されている
Despite the international acclaim, the film has not yet been shown in Japan and has made the news under a cloud of controversy. Lawyers who led the team representing Shiori's successful civil lawsuit in 2019 have now criticized the documentary publicly, taking issue with the film's unauthorized use of CCTV footage that they say was only supposed to be used in court proceedings. The footage shows an intoxicated Shiori being dragged from a taxi and into a hotel lobby by the alleged perpetrator. The lawyers also said that her using secret video and audio recordings without consent has compromised sources who should have been protected.
We are standing in different point of view. For me, public good. For them, do not break any rules. CCTV footage is the only evidence visually when we have to think about what we have to tell through this story.
Our TK correspondent Shaima Khalil was talking to the Japanese film producer Shiori Ito. You're listening to the BBC World Service. A lot more to come in the next 30 minutes, including on Ukraine.
Warum nur an der Oberfläche kratzen? Bei einem Atemwegsinfekt ganz dünnes Eis.
Wenn Erkältungsviren auf die Bronchien schlagen, packt Umkaluabo den Infekt mit der Wurzel. Denn es lindert nicht nur die Symptome, sondern bekämpft auch die Erreger.
Umkaluabo.
Unaussprechlich, aber ausgesprochen gut.
Zu Risiken und Nebenwirkungen lesen Sie die Packungsbeilage und fragen Sie Ihre Ärztin, Ihren Arzt oder in Ihrer Apotheke.
Japanese women are known for having tiny waistlines and one in five young women there are underweight. But Japan's most followed comedian, Naomi Watanabe, is shaking things up. I'm Hannah Gelbart and I've been chatting to her about how she is breaking Japanese body image norms and adapting to life in the Big Apple. You can listen to our conversation on What in the World, a daily podcast that explains what's happening in the world every weekday in less than 15 minutes. You can find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Warum nur an der Oberfläche kratzen? Bei einem Atemwegsinfekt ganz dünnes Eis.
Wenn Erkältungsviren auf die Bronchien schlagen, packt Umkaluabo den Infekt mit der Wurzel. Denn es lindert nicht nur die Symptome, sondern bekämpft auch die Erreger.
Umkaluabo.
Unaussprechlich, aber ausgesprochen gut.
Zu Risiken und Nebenwirkungen lesen Sie die Packungsbeilage und fragen Sie Ihre Ärztin, Ihren Arzt oder in Ihrer Apotheke.
You're with Newsa, and hundreds of thousands of people have been protesting in towns and cities across Greece to mark 2 years since a rail disaster that killed 57 people and injured dozens of others. The disaster shocked Greeks, with many accusing their government of doing too little to shed light on the causes of the tragedy. Maura Lavelle is a journalist in Athens.
There have been protests called in cities all across Greece. I've been reporting in Athens for around 10 years now, and I'm quite certain it is the biggest demonstration I've seen in my time here.
And the protesters, who are they?
This was really interesting. It was a bit of everyone. I saw protesters who were college students, high school students, grandmothers, families with children, football hooligans, political parties. Most shops have been closed all across the country. Civil servants mostly have been out of work for the day on strike. It has quite effectively shut down a bit of the country.
And are the protesters simply marking the anniversary, or are they asking for answers?
They are very explicitly asking for answers. They are asking for justice. The issue here is not just that two trains collided. It's why was the rail system in such a state that two trains could collide? And then why was the investigation so slow? Essentially, no one has been charged, and the investigation still has yet to wrap up 2 years later. Yesterday, the day before the two-year anniversary, Greece's National Aviation Railroad Safety Body concluded their report as to why the crash had happened. And they concluded that it was due to a series of systemic errors, lacking signaling systems, lacking radio systems. There are still many things, however, in that report that remain unanswered. For example, there was a large fire that broke out immediately after the two trains collided, and many people lost their lives in the fire. One thing that was very upsetting for a lot of Greek people, and another rallying cry here, is that phone calls were published of people who were calling the emergency services from inside the train car after the collision, saying, I can't breathe, I don't have oxygen. And this I don't have oxygen has been a call. It elucidated that people died in the fire, and the reason for this fire, as of yet, still remains very unclear.
What has been the response of the government over the years, over the past couple of years, to those kinds of criticisms, and indeed, what position have they taken?
It's been a shifting response from the government here. The governing New Democracy Party and the Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis, the day after the collision, he came out and said that the collision was due to human error. Then over the past 2 years, the government line has been, we're working on the investigation. And then for the past few weeks, there's been sort of a revelation in Greek press every day about the fire and the investigation. And it's been a flood of news and stories. As anger reached sort of a boiling point, the demonstrations and the strike today, the government a bit changed their line and said, we understand the rage.
That was Maura Lavelle, a journalist in the Greek capital, Athens. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. Let's go back to Washington, D.C., and that extraordinarily bad-tempered public clash between President Trump and his Ukrainian counterpart, Volodymyr Zelensky, at the White House. Among other statements, the U.S. president told his Ukrainian counterpart to make a deal with Russia, or we're out.
The problem is, I've empowered you to be a tough guy. And I don't think you'd be a tough guy without the United States. And your people are very brave. But you're either going to make a deal or we're out. And if we're out, you'll fight it out. I don't think it's going to be pretty, but you'll fight it out. But you don't have the cards. But once we sign that deal, you're in a much better position. But you're not acting at all thankful. And that's not a nice thing. I'll be honest, that's not a nice thing.
And following the meeting, President Trump published a statement on his Truth Social network, which we voiced up.
We had a very meaningful meeting at the White House today. Much was learnt that could never be understood without conversation under such fire and pressure. It's amazing what comes out through emotion, and I have determined that President Zelensky is not ready for peace if America's involved, because he feels our involvement gives him a big advantage in negotiations. I don't want advantage. I want peace. He disrespected the United States of America in its cherished Oval Office. He can come back when he is ready for peace.
Well, European leaders have been lining up in support of Mr. Zelensky, the EU's top diplomat. Kaja Kallas said today it became clear that the free world needs a new leader. It's up to us Europeans to take this challenge. The French President Emmanuel Macron said that Russia was the aggressor and that we must respect those who've been fighting since the beginning. President Orban of Hungary, however, thanked the US President for standing for peace. I've been speaking to Marko Mikkelson, the chair of the Estonian Foreign Affairs Committee. I asked him for his reaction to that fiery exchange in the Oval Office.
It's very difficult to give any comment at the moment because something like that, what we witnessed all, we never have seen. And in that critical moment, what we all know what is happening right now in Ukraine with this war of aggression from Russia, it is really sad to see how one of the biggest partners and supporters of Ukraine in this war of independence is just fading away. And I think that why the situation went so far as we see today is connected to the very different understanding how this war should end, perhaps even how this war started. And that is, of course, very, very dangerous moment for all of us, because it seems that we are getting not closer to peace, which will be a just and lasting for Ukraine. That means that Ukraine must fight further on, and most likely with much lesser help from the United States. And that means that European countries must, you know, double up the support to Ukraine right now.
I mean, there's been a predictable response from other European countries lining up behind Mr. Zelensky. But isn't the issue now, how do you bridge the gap between Europe and the United States?
I think that leaders of European countries like Prime Minister Starmer or President Macron and others who have traveled to Washington and tried to somehow rebuild the bridge, which is somehow broken in transatlantic relations right now, didn't do well in a way. But what is most important right now is that Zelensky, President Zelensky, has a very difficult moment, of course, after this meeting, and he needs very solid support. What is most important to stay calm and, of course, to try still work hard through all kind of channels to avoid the very serious divide between Europe and America now.
I mean, stay calm seemed to be furthest from the minds of both Mr. Trump and Mr. Zelensky today. How do you explain the way in which Mr. Zelensky reacted to what Mr. Trump was saying? Is it frustration, do you think, at being left out of negotiations over his country's future?
No, I don't think that this is just because Ukraine has left out from those negotiations, which are not only about Ukraine, as we know. I think this is frustration which has been amounted because there have been a lot of promises, but the execution of those promises or fulfillment of those promises have been very hectic, even from the side of the United States. And now Zelensky is defending from very first day of this aggression, a brutal aggression, the country, and rather successfully, taking into account what are the aims of Russian aggression. So I didn't think that he had any other option rather than to say out loud what is happening, and that ceasefire, which is somehow demanded by Trump, doesn't lead to the lasting and just peace for Ukraine. And if somebody says that you cannot make any decisions about your own security requirements, I mean, you know, membership of NATO or not membership in NATO, then this is a question about sovereignty of Ukraine. And this is what should not be dealt in a way by Americans, as we have seen. And obviously frustration is there.
I mean, do you think that relations between the two countries are reparable after such a public falling out between their two leaders today?
I'm surprised, actually, first and foremost, why this dialogue was public anyway, because it is, obviously, we all know the situation is very tense, and all those messages sent to each other through social media. So that wasn't the good beginning for this kind of meeting. But anyway, it's done now. And there is a lot of work to do to control the damage.
Well, that was Marko Mikkelson, the chair of the Estonian Foreign Affairs Committee. I'm also joined by the former Ukrainian Defense Minister, Andrei Zagorodnyuk. Do you feel, sir, that your country was insulted today in Washington?
Well, we clearly are in an extremely difficult position right now. And the issue is, it's generally very difficult to comment things like that very soon because of this massive emotional part in this discussion. And we all are shocked by this amount of different accusations and the way the whole discussion went, etc. But if we kind of move this all aside and just look at the essence of the problem, is that President Trump considers that Ukraine has no leverage at all and has to pick up any deal which is on the table. And he would be the one who would put the deal on the table. He would agree with Russia. And Ukraine has no voice. And then Ukraine is like, basically have to take it. We all know Russia. We've been dealing with this for years. And we understand that that means that it would be Russian terms. And we all know that Russia has all their like strategic objectives intact, which means that they want to destroy Ukraine and so on. So if these are Russian terms for Ukraine, that means a disastrous terms. And that, and for global peace as well. And so we basically, he understands that. He said, no, we cannot do that. We need adjusting, like a lasting peace with security guarantees. And he was told that, no, you don't have it. So, you don't have a say here.
So how do you win the United States around to Ukraine's viewpoint? Is that even possible?
Nobody knows, because President Trump is a very unique individual, as we all know. So we don't know if it's possible. We know that, first of all, we are dealing right now with the U.S. administration, and there is like enormous amount of people in the United States who are, including in Republican Party, but also generally, who are very supportive to Ukraine. We know that. And so we don't want to say that we have a problem with United States of America, because actually United States of America always been our extremely close friend and so on. What we have problem with is we have a problem with current administration who came there and said that, OK, we want peace, which is fine because we also want peace. We actually want peace more than anyone else in this world. But then peace through acceptance, any deal on the table. That is the problem, because that is not going to lead to peace. So that part we need somehow to explain, that if we are following Russian scenario, that's not going to lead to peace.
How do you think your president acquitted himself today in the Oval Office in his exchanges with President Trump and his vice president? Will there be those in Ukraine who think maybe we need a new leader to negotiate with the United States?
Frankly, we will have all kinds of people because we're a democracy and we have diversity of opinions. But Ukrainian national kind of a feature is that as soon as we are having a sort of a trouble, like from outside, whatever it is, we get united. So what we see right now in the information sphere, in the social media, is actually people unite behind the president. We're not the people who disunite if things go difficult. There could be different interpretations. What could have been done better? Because there's always like a conversation the way it goes, and there's like a fog of like discussion and argument and so on and so on. And clearly, I've seen that some of the members of that, not necessarily President Trump, were actually immediately aggressive to Zelensky, whatever he said, that he's not grateful enough, et cetera, et cetera. And, when you look back at that, you would think, oh, probably what I would do would be this or that. But in reality, that's what happened. But the thing is that this is not going to disunite the Ukrainian society.
Do you think that Ukraine would have become as dependent as it has on the United States? And obviously that dependency grew under President Biden. If Europe had been more supportive, had given you the weaponry that you needed?
A short answer, absolutely yes. Longer is that United States, that was a policy of United States. Policy of United States was that we give more resources than any other country, and so we're going to be setting the strategy here. So they set up a Rammstein format, which was done for coordinate the international help, including UK, EU, and other countries. But the US was playing a key role there. And that happened until President Trump came to the office. So it was like a very clear, like, US sort of dominating position in the whole coalition, in NATO, in coalition for Ukraine, and generally in the whole Western security architecture. Now things changing dramatically. And unfortunately, we are exactly in the middle of this change.
So, look, many, many thanks for joining us. That was Andriy Zagorodnyuk, the former Ukrainian defense minister. And shortly, we hope to be able to speak to a supporter of President Trump after that meltdown today in the Oval Office between him and Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. And we say with our top story, Donald Trump, Volodymyr Zelensky, and J.D. Vance clashing in an extraordinary shouting match at the White House, with Mr. Trump telling the Ukrainian president to make a deal or we're out. Speaking outside the White House, the Republican senator and Trump ally, Lindsey Graham, voiced his support for the US president and asked if Mr. Zelensky was the right man to negotiate with the United States.
What I saw in the Oval Office was disrespectful, and I don't know if we can ever do business with Zelensky again. I think most Americans saw a guy that they would not want to go in business with. The way he handled the meeting, the way he confronted the president, was just over the top. So I think the relationship between Ukraine and America is important, vitally important. But can Zelensky do a deal with the United States? After what I saw, I don't know. He either needs to resign and send somebody over that we can do business with, or he needs to change.
Well, I'm joined now live from Budapest by Fred Flights. He served as chief of staff at the U.S. National Security Council under President Donald Trump in his first term in office, and is vice president of the American First Policy Institute. And Mr. Flights, have you seen video footage of what happened today in the Oval?
Oh, yes.
And what did you make of it?
Well, I think it was really a tragedy and a setback for peace. I was hoping that Zelensky would come to the White House and he would express his issues for a peace deal and Trump would give his red lines. They would sign this minerals deal and we would have progress towards a ceasefire. But it seemed that Zelensky came with some issues that he thought had to be resolved before we talk about a ceasefire. But the biggest issue here is, I mean, Zelensky must have known that feuding and arguing with President Trump in the Oval Office was a bad idea. And
I don't think I'm even going to explain that.
It was disrespectful. I wouldn't want to see that happen in front of the British Foreign Minister or your king. This was disrespectful in front of our head of state. And I don't understand why he thought that was a good tactic. But look, Trump has actually tried to deal with the aftermath of this. He sent a very good Truth Social media post. He said emotions are high. He's willing to meet with Zelensky again when he's ready to talk about peace. So look, Trump is ready to resume the dialogue.
Is it, though, a dialogue?
I think it's a dialogue, and I think there could be some sharp disagreements. But if there are sharp disagreements, it should be done in private. I didn't like it when Joe Biden lectured the Israeli government publicly. I think if we have differences with the Ukrainian government, if Zelensky has some difference with Trump or the way he's approaching this war, he needs to raise them in private.
I mean, I use the word dialogue because at the moment it just seems to be a dialogue between the United States and Russia to reach.
That's nonsense.
That's how it looks at the moment. I mean, I don't think it looks that way at all.
In fact, the discussion that was held in Saudi Arabia.
Tell me about Ukraine's involvement.
There were significant differences between both sides.
Okay.
This was just the first round of discussions between Trump's envoys and the Russians, and there's a lot of work to do.
And at what point is Ukraine, at what point is Europe going to be brought into these negotiations?
They are already involved in the negotiations. There have been numerous meetings between U.S. officials and Zelensky, U.S. officials in Europe. And this temper tantrum that Macron threw when he wasn't invited to the meeting in Saudi Arabia was just simply so ridiculous. I'm very happy to see British and French leaders now realizing that it's more productive to work with President Trump to get a good deal than criticizing everything that he does.
I mean, what does a good deal look like from the U.S. point of view?
That is an excellent question. The problem is it's going to be a deal that will be hard for Ukraine to accept. It's going to be painful. They're not going to get back all their territory, at least in the short term. Russia, the aggressor, is not going to get the justice that they should receive. But Trump's priority is ending the killing. And in his view, continuing to throw weapons at a war of attrition that Ukraine is going to lose is immoral. And that means an imperfect solution is necessary. And frankly, no moral person will be happy about this. But I think Trump is right that stopping the killing as soon as possible is the right way to go. We then begin negotiations on a peace settlement.
I mean, Mr. Trump clearly wants to stop the killing, but does he also sense a business opportunity here? He obviously does with Ukraine in terms of its mineral wealth, but also maybe ultimately with Russia and a renewing of economic relations between Russia and the United States?
Trump is interested in this rare earth minerals deal with Ukraine because he thinks that the U.S. should be compensated for economic and military aid. That's Trump's unique approach to foreign policy. This concession made by Ukraine, it's not that big a concession. Actually implementing that will take years, and getting the equipment there to get those minerals out of the ground. But it was a good faith gesture by Zelensky, and I give him credit for that. Trump believes that there should be a long-term American plan for Russia. And instead of demonizing Russia and driving into the hands of China, I think he would eventually like to normalize relations with Russia. He's even mentioned putting Russia back into the G8. Now, we're a long way away from that, but I think we would all be better off if Russia was an ally and not an enemy that's collaborating with communist China.
I mean, you can see the issue here that Europe regards President Putin, as does Ukraine, as an indicted war criminal. But Mr. Trump's happy to talk to him.
I agree with that. But remember, the UK and the US also made a deal with Gaddafi, who was a war criminal, because it was a deal that we thought we had to make to improve relations with a state with an abysmal human rights record. And sometimes international relations, deals like that are necessary. And I don't think we should make them lightly. But I believe the two nations on Earth with the largest nuclear arsenals should have good relations, and they should be talking.
Mr. Flights, can I just return very briefly to the beginning, so to speak? And after this very public falling out today at the Oval Office, do you think it's possible to reconcile the United States and Ukraine very briefly?
Absolutely. And as I said, Trump has already sent a social media post to that effect. And I believe my former colleague, General Keith Kellogg, I'm speaking for myself, but my guess is he's been on the phone and he probably said to Zelensky, what were you thinking?
Okay, very good. Fred Flights, many thanks. Fred Flights, who served as Chief of Staff at the U.S. National Security Council under President Donald Trump in his first term in office, and is Vice President of the America First Policy Institute. That's it from this edition of NewsHour. From me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London, goodbye.
Japanese women are known for having tiny waistlines, and one in five young women there are underweight. But Japan's most followed comedian, Naomi Watanabe, is shaking things up. I'm Hannah Gelbart, and I've been chatting to her about how she is breaking Japanese body image norms and adapting to life in the Big Apple. You can listen to our conversation on What in the World, a daily podcast that explains what's happening in the world every weekday in less than 15 minutes.
You can find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.